Hey Bruce, how you doing?
Yeah, good, Will. Good. I'm over in Perth at the moment, visiting our new grandchild. So it's Jed. All pretty exciting. I'm over here.
Jed, that's right. So are you getting back to changing diapers? Is that really riding a bicycle? You just kind of get right back on?
That's right, yeah. That's one way. But as I said in an email I shot out a couple of weeks ago, you know, I guess, and everyone listening to this podcast will have the same thoughts, you know, when you have a new member of the family, be it first or second generation down, you sort of reflect back on, you know, what's that world they're going to grow up in? And all of a sudden it brings a bit more urgency, you know.
Yeah, who knows, right? 18, 20 years from now, who knows? It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and the obvious question, you know, what is true? What are facts? You know, what do they really need to know? Facts seems to have taken a new meaning in recent times.
Yeah. So just before we get into that, so for those of you who might be listening for the first time, I'm Will Richardson here in New Jersey, and that's my friend Bruce Dixon in Perth, Australia this week. And we are the co-founders of modernlearners.com. And I want to welcome you to the podcast. And if you are listening and you like what you're hearing, we would really like it if you gave us a review on iTunes or on the Google Play Station. And if you subscribed, we have a bunch more podcasts coming out. And also tell your friends, because we're going to have a lot of conversations about what the world looks like right now, trying to add some context to what we need to be doing in schools. And like you said, Bruce, I mean, there is just a ton of things we have to think about now when it comes to literacy and when it comes to the way that we approach helping kids become literate and actually how we get ourselves up to speed on literacy, right? I mean, that's one of the biggest problems right now.
Yeah, I find it sort of interesting because if you think back over, say, the last decade, you know, turn of the century, 21st century somethings, we all knew about new literacies, you know, that was modern literacies. We sort of got all warm and fuzzy about that, you know, wow, we better focus on what, you know, what literacies look like now and what they should be. And everyone paid attention to it, but I don't think took it as seriously as they should have. And all of a sudden we are now confronted by some realities that are going to really make us, I think, take a much harder look at those literacies, because nobody predicted, I think, the way the world shifted in the last short period of time. And without getting into the politics of it, you know, it's the nature of what we are coming to believe is true and what we're taking as fact and how we're making those decisions about what we believe.
I think one of my favorite expressions these days is, much like a lot of other things, it's a moving target. And, you know, it just changes so quickly. I mean, I'm feeling illiterate right now. And not that I felt like I was aces a couple of years ago, but I thought, yeah, you know, I understand how social media works and I understand how to use some of the technologies. And I look at most of those lists of people who are trying to define what modern literacy is, and I'm kind of checking those boxes going, yeah, you know, I'm doing pretty well. But today, I'm just like, a whole bunch of stuff is happening in terms of our ability to publish, and also just the, you know, like you said, not to get too deeply into the politics, but certainly the emotion now and the motivation that people have to try to create alternative facts or things that aren't true, and to kind of prey on our ignorance, if you will, our inability. I mean, it's really kind of scary. And one of the things that I've been reading a lot about, and I definitely want to get into, you know, at some point here very quickly, in fact, what schools need to be doing right now, because I think that's the larger meta conversation that we need to be having. But one of the things I've been reading a lot about lately is this whole idea of confirmation bias. And I think we used to call that the echo chamber, pretty much. But, you know, now it's gotten this very interesting conversation started about how very difficult it is for us to see the world in a way that doesn't match our kind of historic reality, our experience of it, and that we are really kind of not wired to change our perspective that much. And that's really interesting.
Well, I think it's sort of in very simple terms, in some ways where we're at seems logical. Before, you held an opinion, be it politically or about anything, and your next door neighbor or your friends, you'd have a chat over a cup of coffee or a beer or something, and one or two of them would agree with you, and you'd sort of have a moderately open mind. You'd probably still feel fairly strongly about a lot of these things, but now that you can connect with so many people, both privately, one-on-one, or through, any form of new media, and have confirmation of some of those ideas in so many different ways, it just makes people's arguments more robust. They become much more rigid in their thinking. And then, of course, when you present an opposing position or different ideas or even facts, they discount them because they have confirmation from others that their existing beliefs were right. And I think it's causing some real issues. I was just mindful, as you were saying there, both of us, I think, were fans of what the Mozilla people put out with their web literacy material. And I'm hoping that schools that are listening to this would certainly pay attention to all the resources that are there. I think they've done an amazing job with that. And I also remember, and I'm sure you do, what was it, 15, 20 years ago when Jimmy Wales set up Wikipedia and the delights that people had of debunking it and saying it's fiction and why would you want to do this? And, that was before, we had some sense about where it was going. And the flip we're now at is, I think, we posted in the newsletter a week before last, is that now Wikipedia are coming out and setting themselves up as a sort of fact check organization, not just through the Wikipedia publication, but they have a crowd mechanism that allows them to do the sort of fact checking in a way that can be seen to be more neutral and not politically aligned. And so, as you said, the change that's happening in our world is just happening so rapidly. It's difficult for people to know, what they should believe and what is truth.
So, two things kind of occur to me. The first is today the fact checker has to be in your brain. It can't you can't go to Wikipedia and rely on other people to check facts for you. You have to have the wherewithal. First of all, you have to have the curiosity to want to check the facts and to want to try to glean where truth is. And I think that that's one problem, to be honest with you. And we've been talking about this before too, and writing about the fact that there is certainly a diminishing of curiosity in schools. From the time the kids enter to the time the kids leave. And if you're not curious these days about the world, then you're going to be fed a whole bunch of stuff that isn't true, and you're probably going to be too intellectually lazy or just not be interested in figuring out if it's true or not. So, when we kind of prepare everything for kids, when we make it a one-answer test, that in and of itself, I think, adds to this problem that kids are not curious because why should they be? What reason do we give them in school to be curious? So that's number one. But that article in the New Yorker, and we were talking about this before we hit the record button here, but by Elizabeth Colbert, why facts don't change our
Brilliant.
minds. I think, yeah, it's brilliant. And it's just, I think, crucial for educators to understand that we're not hardwired for this. I mean, we really are wired to confirm what we already know. And so that's why this makes this doubly difficult, triply difficult, if that's a word, in that it's got to be something that we think about really early on, right? Because it's the same type of thing. I mean, if we're not working with first, second, third graders, or at least modeling for first, second, and third graders, that editorial function in our heads and in our process, then they're going to just end up, kind of looking for people to give them answers. And that's going to be their confirmation bias, right? In practice. And I'm not sure if that's making a lot of sense, but you know what I mean, right? We're basically conditioning kids to just wait. And so it's a huge problem right now if A, we're not putting kids out in the world who have a curiosity for the truth. I think that's almost as much of a problem as if we're putting kids out in the world who can't figure it out if they do have the curiosity. So, you know, it's kind of this double-edged sword that we have to do both of those things.
And that means, you know, that we want kids to ask questions. We want them to challenge ideas. We want them to be able to debate and discuss and argue about, you know, the whole breadth of information and knowledge that we share with them in our schools. And that contradicts, you know, a traditional view of school. For many people, you know, it was really about that sort of font of knowledge stuff. And people have taken a long time to become used to the idea that we want kids who, as you said, their curiosity provokes them to ask questions, to want to be able to accept other people's points of view. I thought that article, and as you know, it spoke of a number of the Stanford experiments and a number of others, which, you know, proved beyond doubt that people don't take on opinions other than their own very easily, and one of our biggest weaknesses is our inability to see the weaknesses in our own arguments, in our own cases. And I think I've become, and I think it's a function of what we're talking about. I think it's a function of all the sources of information we have today. But I've become conscious of that for myself. You know, at times I think, gee, you know, I don't look at my own argument, my own thinking, reasoning, objectively at all. I mean, I guess it, you know, it's an oxymoron to say that I do. But however, I think you must be able to think about your own ideas and challenge them at the same time, take on board where other people are at, and build your own opinions about these things. And how do we do that in schools if we want them to be compliant and if we want them to just learn about a certain, you know, round of facts and take it as given, so that they can reproduce it on a test? It's about as far away from the reality they need to face as we can possibly provide them.
Yeah, and I think so. Again, something else we were kind of chatting about before we started recording this, but I think it's interesting. It's, I guess, a bit ironic in school, in a school context, because A, parents have a confirmation bias for the experience that their kids are having, right? That they want it to look the same as they had experienced when they were in school. But I also think there's probably a fair amount of confirmation bias for the teachers who are in schools. It's hard to break out of that kind of school-wide echo chamber. You know that these are the things we do. These are the practices that have been successful for us. Success is defined in this particular way. We're not really going to change that. You know, we're not going to push that or challenge that, because it's just very difficult to change what we do, especially if we think that we're good at what we do.
And that's the point, and it's just a fact of life that many of the people who were brilliant at school as we knew it and in the traditional environment, the people who were really good at it, many of them became teachers. So in many respects, you know, they confirmed the model, and to challenge that model says, well, no, hang on, that's something that I was good at. Why would you want me to be doing something outside my, you know, capacity, outside my level of competence? And so I'm with you. I think the confirmation bias that we get from parents about the models of schools that they like, I think is something that all school leaders, you know, have to be aware of and take on board, because, you know, we talk about the fact that parents want to have the sort of schooling, you know, want the kids to have the sort of schooling that they had. It's one thing just to sort of say that, but you've got to face up to that fact, and you've got to say, if we're talking about changing schools in any way, we better understand the argument. We better understand how we're going to build the argument in a way that can make sense to parents and not take for granted that they'll see the logic of our side. And I think it's perfectly acceptable that most parents, when faced with change or transformation in schools, find it a little bit overwhelming, a little bit threatening, and often put up a lot of objections to it. I think we've got to be aware of that from the outset and build a case which makes sense to them as much as it makes sense to us.
So I think we can build a case, right? I think that there's a compelling
Oh, yeah,
case to
sure.
be made today to fundamentally reimagine schools from the ground up. Now,
I agree.
I'm not suggesting that's easy by any stretch, but I think there's a case to be made. So I guess the question becomes then, so how do you begin to make that case? Because you can't make it by having an all-school assembly, right? I mean, by having all the parents come in and, you know, I mean, as much as I love going in and giving presentations to parents, and I know you do too, because those conversations are rich and really interesting.
Yep.
But that's not going to change. That's not going to change the narrative. That's not going to change the story. It's not a one night thing. You know, it's not a one, you know, beautifully designed PDF that gets sent home to everybody thing. So what are some strategies you think that school leaders need to employ to begin to change that narrative, to change that bias that parents have? Because if we don't do that, you're right. I think change is going to be maybe impossible.
Yeah, I think it's a good question, Matt. And I think, you know,
well, you need
most
answer,
school leaders.
That's the point, right? You got an answer?
Dead right. Yeah, no, I do. I think that in the past, again, the traditional model was there was communication between school and home, and usually it was a weekly or maybe even a fortnightly newsletter, and once or twice a year there was a parent-teacher interview in some sorts, and that was it. That was the end of it. And everyone was fairly happy with that dialogue, basically because parents knew what was happening with their kids when they were at school. It was the same as happened to them. So if we're serious about taking parents down this path of change, of building new models of school, then we literally have to take them down that path. In other words, it's an ongoing conversation. It has to have many forms. It can be a public forum. It can be speakers. I think it's a lot about helping them come in contact with the information that we have, that our school leaders who listen to this podcast have. So it's sharing articles and research and ideas, not sharing research at the professional level. I mean, the article you referred to came out of the New Yorker, and it's obviously deeply rooted to research. But, I mean, I think we can't make an assumption that parents are reading this information or have in contact with. The best example I can give is a trivial one, and that was if you roll back to, say, 15, 20 years ago when kids were sort of starting to use computers reasonably consistently in schools, and they were using spell checkers. Now, from my knowledge, the vast majority of parents didn't like that idea, and they felt that spell checkers allowed kids to cheat. But
providing
you took the time to just simply explain that, in fact, what you find is that what spell checkers do is it allows timid spellers to be more ambitious. It allows them to expand their vocabulary, to use words they wouldn't otherwise use. In like a heartbeat, parents will go, oh, okay, yeah, I get that. But no one's ever taken the time to talk to them about it. Now, that's one tiny little example that happens to involve technology. So if we're going to build a case for very different models of schools, we've got to take parents with us on the journey. That means we do have to pay not lip service but genuine commitment to the notion of a learning community, and that community has to bring parents along. It has to bring them in when the school's going through the process of change. Parents have to be part of that conversation.
Yeah, and there's so many layers to this that make it very, very difficult. And I think that, you know, as we've talked about a lot, it starts with a very clear kind of vision and belief system that you are constantly communicating to everybody, to students, teachers, parents, community members. And it's one that is consistent. And as you said, it shows up in a lot of different ways, right? It shows up in student work. It shows up in the extracurricular activities that you put on at a school. It shows up in the emails that you send home. I mean, you know, I won't name the district, but I'm very attached to a district where the only communication that we get, that comes from this particular district is in the form of a very tersely written email saying there was a lockdown today, you know, type of thing.
Wow.
Or
that's
we're
exciting.
Having, yeah, you know, there's no emotion. There's no, you know what I mean? There's no connection that's being made there. And it sends a message. It's telling the story of that particular school. And so, there, you know, there's that. You have to have a concerted plan, I think, over the long term. And we keep talking about like a school like CCSD 59 and outside of Chicago that just has this brilliant, brilliant, almost marketing team. And that word marketing doesn't usually fit yet, right? But
They're extraordinary.
you don't usually connect marketing with school, but we got to market now. We have to market a different story. It's not enough to just articulate one now. We have to market it. We have to build the capacity of people in the community to understand what that story looks like. And that's the only way that they're going to be brought along. But as you were talking, the one irony is, so parents have to be curious too, right? And in many cases, they are curious, but most of what they're curious about is what grade is in the parent portal. What does my kid need to do to get a, whatever, get to college, get an A? So we need to change their questions too. We need to help them develop a different sense of curiosity. And I think we can do that by grounding that work in the fact that the bigger questions are really different now, that it's not the same world of work that our kids are stepping into. It's not the same world of literacy, right? That the old literacies are not going to sustain. And again, that's just a long-term, very clearly articulated and well-developed plan that is put into place that is just constantly dripping information and stories and pictures, whether those are literal pictures or kind of mental pictures of what learning needs to look like and how your particular district, that particular district is moving toward that. It's really hard. It takes a lot of time, and you got to really be thoughtful about it.
Well, you mentioned CCSD 59. I mean, I just to refer to people, that's one of the podcast interviews that you've done, and I'd strongly recommend to people when it comes up to take the time to listen to it, because I mean they've taken it on head on, and they realise that this is a marketing challenge. They've got a marketing person full time, and on the surface, if you just heard someone say, "Oh, this district's just put a, they've got a strong marketing plan, they've got strategies in place," you could see that as just being sort of like, showing off or just, trying to do it for sort of trivial reasons. And then you look at what they've actually done and the way they've, I mean, we've got to have transparency. We've got to let people, we've got to let parents, we've got to let the wider community into the schools and into the classrooms. And into doesn't mean they just wander through it in their own time, because frankly, most parents don't have that extra time. But it does mean that, for instance, and they do this at 59, I know, that they can make short, sharp videos to the point. If it's good enough for, Ted to do an 18-minute video, it's good enough for 59 to do a 59-second video about what a particular teacher, school leader, specialist, someone in the school district is doing, and sharing those ideas. It's what some schools will do when they have, exhibition nights, which aren't just a one-off sort of pretend event. These are nights where, there's a whole event put together, and parents see the rigor and the depth to which kids are going in the work and the projects they're doing. So it's not a one-off. It's not just videos, or it's not just more newsletters. I mean, the technologies are there. I mean, let's be frank. And it's not all about the technologies, but if we've got them at our fingertips, we've got to use them.
And they do something that a lot of people probably who are listening to this podcast, A, have never thought of, and B, probably have never heard of in a school district. They have their own branding guide. I mean, they get down to the point
Fantastic.
where there's a line in their branding guide that says, when we take photos of kids, we never look down on them. And when you
Isn't that
think about,
magical?
it's magic. I mean, when you think about
It's
how
pretty.
much thought went into that, just that one sentence, that every picture we take of a kid is going to be at a kid's level. It's going to show what the kid sees, and from his kind of or her worldview. I think it's just brilliant. And so I think that that's a big piece of this, right? Is building the capacity of the community and going through that to talk about change. But I just want to circle back around real fast before we finish up, back to this idea of literacy and being able to glean the truth, figure out what the truth is. I think You know, from that standpoint, one of the big problems that I see is that most schools do the kind of 3-week information literacy unit in the second half of eighth grade, yep. and then they check the box and they think that they're kind of done with that. And I mean, if you're a school leader right now and you're not looking at modern literacy as defined by Mozilla, which again, we'll link in the show notes, and NCTE and others, if you're not defining literacy like that, and you don't have a clear articulation of how you're going to develop those literacies K through 12, you're missing the point. You're not paying attention, yeah. because that's the only way this is going to happen. There is a culture of literacy now that has to be established. This is not just reading and writing. This is about technology. Yeah. It's about connecting with other people. It's about discerning, you know, good apps from bad apps. I mean, it's all that stuff that kids are doing on a daily basis that they're going to be doing to even more complexity as they get older and as they leave us. And we need, and just final point, and then I'll let you chime in, but we also need to articulate how we build our own literacy as the adults in the room to do those types of things. I don't think every teacher needs to know how to program, but every teacher needs to understand the value of programming. And, yep. you know, and every teacher needs to understand what it means to publish something to the web and to be transparent about their work and to connect with other people and those types of things. I mean, I think all those things are good to do, but if you don't at the very least understand the value of those things, how yeah. are we going to create kids who can function in a world where all those things and many, many more things are going to be absolutely required of them?
Yeah, and just a final comment before you wrap. I think the thing that everyone has to keep on in their mind is that parents want this. Parents are hungry for this support, this information. We've got to realize, I think at many times, you know, our view in schools can be that, you know, parents don't really need to know this or they're not interested in these things. Just some of those things you mentioned there. I mean, you know, what should kids be doing on social? How should they be using social media? In what ways can that bias their thinking? You know, and not just the bad stuff, not just the scary stuff. You know, what age should we have kids engaged with this material, and how can we help them use the material that's at their fingertips to make better choices? And I think that, you know, a vast majority of parents are absolutely hungry for this information. They're looking for the guidance. They get it, I think, in bad batches out of much of, not all of, the media. And I think they're looking for schools and school leaders to provide them with some of this guidance. So I think the more that school leaders can engage their wider communities in critical conversations around these ideas and have broad discussions, I think the more they'll get support in their work and the more they'll get support for the evolution of the model of school that they have, and look for one that is really attuned to the needs of the young people in the modern world.
And that's not to minimize the courage that takes, by the way. Because,
oh, yeah.
Because it's a lot easier to just keep on keeping on and just, you know, keep everybody happy and just, you know, keep following that old narrative and not changing it so that there isn't that kind of dissonance. But I think we have to seed that dissonance almost now in the community. And yep. that takes a lot of courage. And speaking of courage, I just want to, you know, wrap this up by saying, you know, this may be the last podcast that you and I do together, Bruce, because you're going to be, when is it, Saturday? You're going to be swimming with the sharks?
Saturday we have what's called, over here in Perth, the Rottnest Island Swim, which is 19.8 kilometers, which is about 14 miles.
14 and, yeah, miles in the deep ocean.
I'm doing it as part of a team, but there's a couple of thousand people do it, and there are some things in the ocean that we'd rather weren't there, particularly around this part of the world. But hopefully we will get to talk in a week's time or so.
It is true that they have helicopters flying above looking out for great whites, right? Isn't that true?
They certainly do. Absolutely.
Well, I tell you got more courage than I do to jump in that water. So sincerely, Bruce, good luck, buddy.
And hopefully we'll be talking again next week.
I hope you finish. All right, Ben. Take care, mate.
Cheers.